The Gambling Files podcast presents Desert Island Discs with your host, John Bruford. Hello and welcome to Desert Island Discs, the podcast that is definitely not playing on any similarities to any other shows, podcasts, programs anywhere in the world. Anybody that suggests different is a fool and a communist. I'm your host, John Bruford, joined in this episode by, I think, only our second operator, which is very exciting.
You mean I'm the first? Whoa.
And now, normally, you would be. But Gary Green was available a little sooner.
Okay.
But listen, if you can top Gary's Johnny Cash story, I will delete his episode.
Okay. Challenge on.
Oh, what a story that was, though. Incredible. So anyway, this is the podcast that poses the question that other podcasts don't bother with, because why would you? We take prominent figures in the gambling industry, thought leaders, if you will. I'll probably think of some other buzzwords in a minute. And we ask them, you're stranded on a tropical island. What do you take with you? You can choose three albums, three books, three movies, one song, not on the albums, one pet from any point in your life, one object, and your basics are taken care of. So think, well, you could go luxury, I suppose. You could go practical. One dessert, very important, and two pieces of advice, one from your younger self to your older self, one from your older self to your younger self. And you can choose when you receive that advice. Delighted to say that we are joined by, he would normally have been the first operator on here because, you know, he's local. The magnificent Simon Thomas, executive chairman of London's Hippodrome Casino. Simon, welcome.
John, it's a pleasure being here, even if I'm second.
Well, you know, the second and the second.
Second, so that's fine.
But the second and the second. Honestly, the Gary Green episode was amazing. He had one story about Tupac Shakur, and that's a rapper. And one, the Johnny Cash story, the whole thing was worth it for the Johnny Cash story. He went for a barbecue at Johnny Cash's house. With Johnny Cash. It wasn't like Johnny Cash was already dead or was out for the weekend. Cash was there. And Kris Kristofferson was there. It's the most fantastically bonkers story. Love it. But anyway, look, there's no pressure. Okay? This is about Simon Thomas. So Simon, you're stranded on a tropical island. Your basics are taken care of. You've got food. You've got shelter. Well, you've got food, but you haven't got dessert. You've got shelter. You've got fresh running water. You're okay. But these are the things that are going to keep you sane. And these are the things that are important to you in some way, usually. Not always, but usually. So let's start with the music. Let's start with the albums. What's your first album choice for your tropical island?
Breakfast in America. It takes me back to my sort of 1970s. My father had a soft top car, and it was just like that idyllic, youthful period where nothing mattered, no pressure, nothing going on in the world, and other than all the crises and things like that. But driving through the south of France, top down, listening to "Breakfast in America" on the 8-track in the time, it was that long ago. It was just glorious. Just, you know, when you have hear a sound and it takes you to a space where you can feel, you can hear, you can smell. Every sense is so distinctly recorded, just triggered by that particular song.
Well, it's a really interesting choice in exactly that respect, but it's Supertramp, right?
Yeah.
So because there is such a distinctive production of the album. It's unique. You hear a song from that album on the radio, and you know, if you've heard it before, you know what album it's off. It's really, really distinctive. And so it kind of fits totally with what you're saying, you know, that it evokes this sort of singular experience for you, but it's also unique itself. Okay. Any particular highlight track for you?
Oh, Dreamer. Love it. It's just... But the songs are all brilliant, but Dreamer's just... you think of the youth at that time and sort of you're dreaming about the future, you're dreaming about everything, and it's just glorious.
But also, and, you know, stop me if this is too personal, but this is a personal kind of show. You know, I've lost both my parents, and I think when I just catch something that very distinctly reminds me of my mum, it stops me in my tracks, and it really makes me smile. And I think, you know, what you're talking about doing this with your dad, obviously I knew your dad and he was a lovely man. But it is that a big part of that happy evocation? Is it the doing with your dad?
Well, it was mum and dad at the time. He was driving, so he was in control of the music. It does take you back to the time. Both parents alive, they're both healthy, and the future's all looking glorious and rosy and fun, and obviously lots of work to be done, but you don't really realize it at the time.
No, the luxury of youth, right? Okay, that's a really interesting choice to kick off with. What's your second album?
Songbird by Eva Cassidy.
Ooh.
She was just an amazing singer. She actually became more famous after she died than before. But she died of cancer. I think she was 33. She just has this most amazing, haunting, melodic voice. And she does some cover tracks like Songbird, but just does them in an extraordinary way. And it's generally her and the guitar. So it's very pure. The title song from the album, Songbird, the lyrics, when you actually read them, it's very short, but it's just beautiful. And it kind of, I suppose for me, it hit a period of my life when I was going out with, I just married to my wife, I think the album was late 90s, and it's all about love and the birds tweeting and the birds know there's love going on. And it's beautiful.
It is a gorgeous song, and it's there's a lot of versions of it, but hers is arguably more famous than the original.
Yeah.
But also that's a surprisingly contemporary choice for you, because I can't remember when her version of it came to prominence, but do you remember how it came to prominence?
Not particularly. There was a singer who loved her.
How it came to prominence was Terry Wogan.
Really?
He heard it and just played it every day, and played more of her stuff, and it just grew and grew and grew. Because at the time, he had the biggest breakfast show in the UK, you know, 7 million odd listeners every day. And she became absolutely huge on the back of that. And of course, as you say, she'd already died at that point as well.
Yeah.
But you're dead right. I mean, her vocals have a really... Songbird was sung at a friend of mine's funeral by another friend when I was 20. By another friend who's also a singer, Mara Carlisle, if you ever want to look her up, she's phenomenal. And so I went for decades avoiding the Eva Cassidy one.
Oh.
Because I knew it would break me in two if I heard it again. And I heard it, and honestly, I could not stop crying. Because it took me right back there. Because, again, it's one of those sounds that just takes you somewhere. Yeah. She takes you out of your skin.
That is James Blunt's Goodbye, My Lover. And a friend of my father's, Jack Jones, died. And at his funeral, his son was the singer. And he sung Goodbye, My Lover as his father was being carried out with his to his mum. And that's just, oh, my God.
God, that must have been so hard.
Yeah,
I mean, just to execute it.
Listening to it, let alone singing it.
That's unreal. Wow.
Yeah.
That's hardcore.
Mm.
I mean, me waiting 20 years to listen to a song is, it pales in comparison to that. Wow. Okay, song. Let's see, that's another surprising choice. I was expecting, you know, I was expecting us to be going through opera.
Nah.
I'm just kidding.
I'm much more of a ballet man than opera. But my third choice is actually is classical. And I probably listen to more classical music now than anything else. When I get in the car with the kids, they put on a dad playlist because they know that I can't stand rap and anything too modern, because I like something that has a message, a soul, a sort of, or a serenity. And Pachelbel's Canon in D is probably 16th century, but it is just, it's one of those stunning pieces of music. I actually learned to play it on the piano, and it starts off, you know, in life sometimes you're a little bit down, you're under pressure or whatever, and it just starts off calm and it just builds up gently into this happy crescendo, and it makes you feel positive and anything can be done. And that's, it's my pick me up music.
I might have to try that today.
Yeah, it's a great bit of music.
Do you know, I don't know it, and I listen to a lot of classical.
Wow. Pachelbel's Canon in D.
I've noted it now.
Well, you will have heard it, I'm going to assure you, because it's
maybe
fairly well known.
I mean, I mostly recently I've been listening to a lot of Max Richter. Are you familiar with his work?
No.
He did the best album I've ever heard. Bear with me here. Richter, as in scale, R-I-C-H-T-E-R. He did an album called Sleep, and it's based around the frequencies of the brain during our sleep cycles. It's 8.5 hours long. When they perform it live, they do it overnight with cots. But it is the most beautiful album I've ever heard. It has everything, absolutely everything. It's extraordinary. Give it a listen, honestly.
I might not get it all in one go, though.
Yeah, it took me a few months to actually hear the whole thing, because there are occasionally times, let me put it this way, I don't put it on when I'm driving.
Yeah.
It's called Sleep for a reason. Okay, wow. That's, three interesting choices. I'm still struggling with Supertramp. I can't believe you went for that.
It just, for me, like you, that the emotional connection with that, with Eva Cassidy at the funeral for you, it is that emotional connection with my parents and with the smells and sounds and sights of south of France when you're a carefree sort of young teenager, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't in the south of France, but I do remember that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, should we get into books?
Whatever you like. You're in charge.
I'm so not. Let's do your books. What's your first choice?
1984, George Orwell. Obviously a classic book, but it's sort of book, every time you read it, you see more in it. And I think when we've just lived through this awful COVID period, you realize just how easy it is for governments to take control of people. And that coercive psychological manipulation that we experienced during COVID, no different to sort of the 1984 dystopian world or what we're going through now with perma-crisis and what people suffered in the First and Second World Wars with government taking control of all of the narrative, treating people with contempt, isolating them, controlling them, threatening them, intimidating them. It's a very sad reflection of the world, but that's the world we live in. And it's possibly a necessary thing to control people. Otherwise, people just run amok. But he laid it out so beautifully. Very clever.
Yeah, it's a very simple book. You know, it's a very low barrier to access it. You can read it and not think it's a super clever thing. Because Orwell was writing at a time when it was like a little golden age of I'm not going to say subtlety, because an awful lot of books at that time were not subtle in the slightest. But if you look back at all right, slightly later, I think, but like Brave New World and books like that. There's a really subversive undercurrent to an awful lot of stuff that was around, say, about 1880 to about 1930. There's like this, and a lot of this literature is completely forgotten now. But there's a reason that Orwell isn't. And that's because and Fahrenheit 451, obviously much later, but Fahrenheit 451 does a similar sort of job, I think, it's sort of emotionally, in provoking questions, in provoking conversation. And that's why books like that will never die.
You mentioned Brave New World. That would have been I toyed between 84 and Brave New World because they're in the similar space. Do you know Orwell and Huxley, I'm trying to which way around it was, one of them was tutor to the other one. That
Orwell would have tutored Huxley, I would have thought.
Yeah. So but they have a connection. And the Huxley...
That makes sense.
And you see the way now, think of the Brave New World with the population being given soft narcotics at the end of the day just to keep them calm. And all over the world, they're legalizing marijuana. It's kind of good.
Combine that with social media and you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it also, when you look at the manipulation of entire populations using social media and using media in a very scientific way to tick boxes in people's brains. So we are living in an absolutely terrifying time where we have an entire generation that has not learned critical thinking.
Yeah.
And we're just buying this wholesale and it is, yeah. Yeah, I can totally see why you chose that. okay. And also it's a nice short read. It's a couple of hours.
Yeah. It's great books. You can read it over and over again, which is... And each time you read it, you see a different levelings.
Do you know my favorite short book?
Tell me.
Are you familiar with Kurt Vonnegut?
I know the name. I've not read any of it.
He's the one writer, when I read his stuff, I absolutely marvel at it. It's concise, evocative, it has real power. And you know that to write something that simple has probably taken quite a long time. But he wrote a book called Cat's Cradle. Again, it's probably a 2.5-hour read. And it's absolutely sensational. Anyway, sorry. It's about Simon Thomas, not John Bruford.
I'm getting some good tips here. I'm writing them down.
So that's what I'm here for. what's your second book?
Second book, actually funny, the song Bird. Bird Song. Sort of reversing the words here. Sebastian Faulks. I actually met him shortly after reading the book, and I remember saying to him, you know, I really, really wish I've not read Birdsong. And he looks at me in slight concern. I said, so I could have the pleasure of reading it again for the first time, because it's just such an amazing book. And it ticks so many boxes with history and a love story. But I think to understand a little bit more of the horrors of the First World War, but also to have a sort of, there's a First World War storyline and a 1970s storyline running concurrently. And the chap, Stephen, who's in the First World War and lives through the horrors, his granddaughter in the 1970s is researching him, going through his letters and diaries and whatever. And I think for me, it was just understanding how much of our own culture is dependent on the legacies of our parents and grandparents, and stuff that happened in the First World War was still having an impact on sort of people in the 1970s. And when I'm with my kids, I realize I'm teaching them my culture. I'm teaching them how I work, and some of that will live on through them and through their children.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a thought the other day. I was listening to some music in the car with the kids, and I thought, after I'm gone, they're probably never going to hear this music again because I listen to some really obscure shit. And I thought, if they ever, they're not going to hear any of it. They're not going to turn the radio on and hear something I listen to. It's never going to happen.
Yeah. I find that they're sort of driving along. They put a song on. It takes them back to a happy road journey with you and whatever, like me with Supertramp.
If radio still exists then. But no, I mean, it was Birdsong was a huge book. I mean, it was a massive book. I mean, that was Foulkes's great big hit, wasn't it? And he became a prestige author on the back of that, if I remember right.
And he did a trilogy following that, All Around the Wars, and they're equally good. But having Birdsong, obviously, was the first one you read, so you always think it's the best. But the other two are good as well. I think Charlotte Gray and I can't think of the name of the third one, but they're good books. He's a good author.
Oddly, you know, often when I'm speaking to people on this, I've read what they're talking about, but in this instance, I've never read Birdsong because I have this weird thing where I don't read things that I'm or watch things that I'm pretty sure I'm going to like. I watch things I'm not sure about, and the things that I like get to stay in a big pile and wait until.
There are bits of Birdsong which are horrific. Some of the horrors of the First World War and people tunneling under each other, and the Welsh miners being tunneling experts, trying to get under the German trenches, and the Germans doing the same the other way and blowing each other up, and these people getting buried alive. Just awful.
Was something that we genuinely forget. I mean, First World War ended obviously over 100 years ago. And I think one of the things that we forget is that that war had so many firsts in it. If I remember right, it was the first war where aircraft were used. It was the first war where tanks were used. It was the first war where I think poison gas was used. And these people were seeing it. Can you imagine having never even conceived a tank before, having one coming towards you?
Possibly like the Ukrainians with the various types of drones that are in operation now. You think the Ukrainian war has been going on longer than the First World War?
That's crazy, especially if you actually date it back to the old Crimean takeover. Wow. Much longer. But, yeah, let's not get too political. It's really difficult not to have a political conversation in the present day, isn't it? What's your third book?
Third book's much more fun. Bill Bryson, Notes from a Small Island. I think he's not a very funny man when you meet him, talk to him, but he's one of the funniest authors I've ever read. And when he takes a subject that I assume I'm familiar with, being England, you see it from an American's point of view, who actually bothers to travel from Land's End to John O'Groats, I learned so much more about my own country, about the idiosyncrasies of the British and what makes us tick. And I do love a book that is literally laugh out loud funny.
Well, that was a book as well. That book was completely embraced by Britain.
Yeah.
It was, you know, everybody loves that book. Interestingly, he goes through my hometown. He goes through Ludlow. And if I remember right, he asks the question, how have the people of Ludlow been mistreating their cats so badly to warrant a shop the size of the Cats Protection League shop? And sadly, that shop's not there anymore. It's now a restaurant where my ex, mother of my children, works. It's called Kin Kitchen. And I've got to say, if you're ever in Ludlow, try the cakes. She's a terrific cake cook.
You're rather into your desserts, aren't you?
No, I can't eat them. That's why I like to talk. I'm living vicariously on other people's dessert memories. It's made me the man I am today. That's why I'm so damn fat. Okay, Bill Bryson. It's funny. I mean, an awful lot of very funny writers are not, you know, ebullient or... that's not uncommon, I don't think.
there's some brilliant. I mean, you take someone like Stephen Fry, he's very funny in real life and very funny as a writer. I love actually the, what's a book, his book, The Liar. My favorite opening line.
Terrific. What was that?
No, he lied.
There's a line I love from that book as well, because it's a really good book and it's beautifully written. I can't remember the narrator's name, but he's in the toilet at his school and he's being hurried along by somebody from outside. And they say something like, come on, chop, chop, one to wipe and one to polish. That really made me laugh. Okay. Let me see. Where are we? Three movies.
Movies. There's so many brilliant, brilliant movies. So I narrowed it down to Leon, which is a great movie. Obviously, it's about an assassin killing people, which is always good news. They're killing bad people. But Natalie Portman is a young girl in there. Her parents are killed by a corrupt policeman. The assassin, Jean Reno, is in the room next door. He takes her in, and you get this. It's a lovely story because there's a human connection between a very lost little girl and a very emotionally controlled assassin. Great action movie, but it does have such an amazing tenderness between killing lots of people. Love it.
I mean, there's serious talent in it. You've mentioned Jean Reno, you mentioned Natalie Portman, a career-defining performance probably from Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
But there's a moment in it, you know, where Gary Oldman and his cronies, they go to Natalie Portman's family's apartment and they wipe them out. And she clocks what's going on and she walks past their daughter, Jean Reno's door. That moment is absolutely stunning because you've got her face half the camera and you can see what's happening behind her and she's just trying to hold that shit together. An actor that young doing that. I was listening to a podcast recently about the making of Stand By Me because it's the 40th anniversary. And Will Wheaton, who was the lead in that, said that Rob Reiner had been adamant that he wanted boys that were like the characters to play the characters because you can't put something into a child that's not already there. But I think Natalie Portman proved him wrong there.
Yeah.
Because that scene is just unreal. And see, that's a surprising choice straight away. A Luc Besson film, I can't remember if it's his first or his second Hollywood movie. Fifth Element would have been Hollywood, surely. Yeah. But anyway, it's a fantastic movie. Okay.
The Luc Besson, the Jean-Jacques Annet French movies were sort of part of my youth, I suppose. And it's quite nice to see him doing an American movie. So,
yeah, now talking about Jean-Jacques Benet, I was having a conversation with Robin from IGB last night about going to see The Big Blue at the cinema. And obviously, I mean, for a lot of us, that was the first time I saw Jean Reno in a movie, and he's fantastic in that. But it was a 35mm print that hadn't been restored at all, and it just looked absolutely awful on the screen. That was degrading and it was terrible. But no, that period, and Jean-Jacques Benet's diva.
Yeah, diva. Nikita. Amazing.
I was on eBay last night looking for the French Nikita poster. The French poster is beautiful. It's so beautiful. I'm going to buy it one day, but it's like £100, so it might have to wait. But if you haven't seen that poster, look up the French poster. It's gorgeous. Sorry, your second film choice.
Second film, Bottle Shock, which is all about the 1976 Judgment of Paris, where there's a British wine cellar. It's actually Stephen Spurrier, who's definitely not British. But playing, it's the actor was played by Stephen Spurrier was the British chap, and he was played by what's his name? Come back to me. By an American actor who's just plays the role so well. But anyway, Spurrier is a little bit upset about the French attitude towards anything non-French, so he heads off to California, trawls around, brings back what he thought were the best French wines. And then brings them back to Paris, and they have a blind wine tasting. He challenges the establishment. And these sommeliers from all of the great restaurants and the French wine experts, they all choose the American wines as the top. And it was a moment in wine history when the New World wines started getting taken seriously. And it's all down to one man challenging the system. And there's a nice little play in there, because obviously I had a very strong father figure in my life working with him. When the father-son relationship in one of the chateaus, Chateau de Montelena, is playing out in the movie, and they have to work through a few issues. And it all comes together with this sort of change in the world. But it's a great, great movie, and it's actually based on history.
Nice. And again, you've surprised me. I had to look it up because I wasn't familiar with the name, but I am familiar with it. I haven't seen it. Alan Rickman, Bill Pullman, and Chris Pine were the leads.
Yeah, Alan Rickman. He plays that role so well, which is obviously a challenge being an American, but great.
Also features the wonderful Dennis Farina.
Well, I'll take your word on that.
He's a fabulous actor. He's a guy, he got his start, I think it might have been with Michael Mann in one of his films, one of his early films like L.A. Takedown, something like that. And he was acting as a consultant because he was a policeman and ended up taking a small part in it. Absolute duck to water moment, and became an actor suddenly. And it's completely bizarre, but he's wonderful in everything I've ever seen him in. So I might have to watch it. He's the kind of actor where I'll probably watch this because I know he's in it now.
Yeah, I watch it, definitely. And if you like wine movies, Sideways is obviously the other classic, and that's all about Pinot Noir.
That's a very funny film. Okay, so Bottle Shock. What's film three?
Third, we're going back to France for the third movie, Dinner des Cons. And you have to watch the French version. The Americans did a version of it, Dinner of the Idiots.
Dinner for Schmucks was the American one, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a classic French farce, but there's so much going on in it. There's a load of French intellectuals that have a weekly dinner party, and they think it's fun to find an idiot who they bring along and basically mock, and then they vote which one's idiot was the best. And the protagonist in it, who's called Pierre, somebody or other, he finds this guy, Francois, who loves building matchstick models. And he goes, oh, you must come and meet my friends. And basically flatters this man. The Francois turns up at this dinner party, and it spirals out of control. Pierre has a back problem, and Francois offers to help him, and he gets sort of embedded in the life. And Francois is a really nice human being. And Pierre's a manipulative, nasty intellectual. And to see the nasty intellectual who was setting out to humiliate the idiot, Francois, actually needing his help. But even then, it just spirals. And just right at the end, when Francois helps Pierre, because Pierre has a problem with the tax man, and Francois happens to know the tax man. And there's a line right at the end, which I adore, where they've smoothed over the issues with the tax man, and they've got the tax man round for dinner. And he says, the tax man likes a little glass of wine. Do you have any wine? He says, yeah, of course, I've got Petrus, I've got Margaux, I've got Lafitte. And he goes, oh, you can't give him that stuff. You'll know you've been fiddling your taxes. And Pierre goes, I haven't worked the way that I have to have cheap wine. And as somebody who likes wine, it's something I aspire to just drink decent wine.
Another interesting choice. And I'm a fan of French movies myself. In fact, any country that has a film industry that just makes films for that country.
Yeah.
There's just something really healthy about that. Years ago, I had a stint as a projectionist. and I projected this film that I've not seen since, but my God, it knocked my socks off. It was called Tatty Danielle. Are you familiar with it?
Nope.
Nobody does black comedy like the French. It's about an elderly aunt who's taken in by her family to live with them, even though she doesn't want to. And she is dead set on killing herself because she's had enough. It's just...
That's a great storyline.
Wonderfully dark comedy. Absolutely just completely wrong. It's fabulous. But there is a bit of a French thing in some of this, isn't there?
Oh, totally. France is a big part of my life. So my parents had places in South France and Courchevel. So my summers were out there. My first real love was a French girl. And then I had another French girlfriend. So I've got so much emotion. I was actually convinced, I'm 100% convinced I'd end up marrying a French girl. So I think they're just so lovely. And Fiona, my wife, she's half Irish and half Italian. And if you actually biangulate the two of them, the midpoint of Dublin and Rome is bang in the middle of France, a place called Saint-Fargeau. So on average, I console myself with the fact she's on average French.
I just love the fact that you did that.
Well, it amused me.
Just in case. Fantastic. I think we've all got a, like, obviously I've been around for work. And I think if I were going to choose a country that I just, after that first visit, you just feel like, yeah, this kind of works for me. For me, it would have probably been Slovenia. I just like 70% of the country is woodland. What's not to love?
Wood, that's good.
As long as you like a good tree.
Yeah. That's great, great country.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful. I've only been once, and I behaved terribly. I was at the American Film Festival in Deauville, attending a Lifetime Achievement Award for the producer, Jerry Weintraub. I behaved very, very badly, but somehow didn't get thrown out of France. Yeah.
Normal behavior for the French.
I don't know. I was pretty bad. But it was a long time ago, and I've grown up a lot since then. So your one song that is not on the albums?
Beatles, Let It Be. It's another feel. It's just the world is an absolute shithole, really. We're very lucky to live in the elevated places we live in where it's relatively clean, relatively safe, but the world's pretty tough out there. And the perma crisis we're all... suffer is there, and when you actually get a song which just says, "Look, just let it be, live with it. Don't complain. Don't whinge." There's a philosophy I love in life, which is when you have a problem, you've actually only got three choices: accept, change, or walk away. And if you can't accept it and you can't change it, you've got to walk away. If you can't walk away, you can't change it. You've got to accept it, and let it be is just that brilliant. Accept it. Life's okay, and we can have a brilliant life. Don't worry about the stuff you can't change. Don't worry about the stuff you can't accept. Just get on with it.
What do you think is one of the hardest lessons in life is learning that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost the definition of being a grown-up, although not everybody has learned it, or being an adult, I should probably say.
Yeah. There's actually a slightly simpler version of that, accept, change, walk away, which I've had to adopt when doing something like the Hippodrome, which is proved to be a little bit more grown up, a little bit more of a challenge than I'd really anticipated. Massive learning curve, huge insurmountable problems coming left, right and center during the licensing, during the build, and then during the operations. And you're in so deep, walk away is no longer an option. So you've got to find solutions to everything. And Hannibal, when he was asked how he'd get the elephants over the Alps, he said, "I will find a way or make a way." And that has become part of our company mantra. When somebody comes up with a big problem, it's like, okay, hear what you're saying, find a way or make a way. And when you've actually got the confidence, there is a solution. It might not be easy. It might be difficult. It might be painful, but there is a solution. Just get on with it. Find a way, make a way. A brilliant example of that, actually, during the build, we were digging the basement out and found a 3-ton lump of iron, which we think was a counterweight for some of the lift equipment or stage equipment or whatever. And the biggest crane we could get in the building would only pick 2 tons up. And so we go, okay, find a way, make a way. And all of these ideas about cutting it into smaller pieces, getting 2 cranes in, lifting it together. And then one of the guys said, bury it. We don't need to take it out of the building. And the solution was there all the time. And so simple. And they just dug a slightly bigger hole and rolled it in there. Somebody in some future renovation of this place will find a 3-ton weight in a big hole, thinking, what the hell's that they're doing that down there?
In the meantime, I hope they got promoted.
Yeah.
Okay, fabulous. You can now choose one pet from any time in your life.
I have one pet who was just the most amazing companion, a golden Labrador called William. And he was there through most of my childhood. And I remember him as a puppy bouncing along, then becoming a sort of mature dog. And I'd go running with him in the forest behind my parents' home. And he would always be just slightly ahead of me. And then as I'm growing up and getting stronger, fitter, he's starting to age. And I'm always marginally competitive and trying to outrun this beast. And then as I'm getting... as he's on his way down, I'm on my way up. I started sort of, he couldn't keep up. And it realized the whole fragility of life and slowing down, taking care of him. And he'd been such an amazing dog taking care of me. I'm actually bubbling up thinking about him.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
He was a great dog. He was completely a free thinker. He'd walk down to town in the morning and go to the butchers who'd give him a bone. He'd then go to the greengrocer who'd give him some water and biscuits, and then they'd phone my mother, and then mum would go and pick him up. He had life so well sorted.
That is a bit special.
Yeah.
As my vet said when she's given me the news that my dog had cancer, and I just fucking fell apart. And she just said, some people are lucky enough to find their dog in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Like when somebody puts it like that.
Yeah. One of my regrets of life, because Fiona works a lot and she's has a family business in Ireland, so she's to and from Ireland all the time. And with my work, the hours are long and somewhat dysfunctional. So yeah. We've never had a pet with it together, because we'd have to have a housekeeper as well as a pet, because we couldn't be able to deal with it. And
there's still time.
Yeah, absolutely. I do love dogs.
Yeah, I've got 2 downstairs right now. Everybody loves my dog except me. I just think, God, he's a knobhead. But I'm currently looking after my significant other's dog. She is a tiny little spaniel, jet black. Prettiest dog I think I've ever seen. And when you meet her, if you get the old approval, she'll just put her paws around your neck and give you an actual hug.
Oh.
It's dangerously adorable. Combine it with the spaniel eyes, you know what I mean? She knows what she's doing. Lucy, you're grounded. Okay, one object. What would you choose?
A pencil. I am...
Okay.
It's very good for poking people. But no, I always have a pencil with me. Or I'm a complete list maker. I have so many things going on in my life, so much stuff. And the way for me of dealing with it is to just write it down. I have lists galore. And I love when I've done something, rubbing out, clearing it off the list. And it's just a way of completely de-stressing. I can function. I can get tons of stuff done. I can manage lots of stuff concurrently because I know I've got it organized. And much easier than having a digital thing. I often copy it over onto digital, but I still have a paper diary. And I have a month to view paper diary and tiny little writing, so I can see my whole month. It drives me mad when I'm using a digital diary and I have a late dinner, then I realize I've got an early morning the next morning and that I should have organized it better. On the paper diary, you can see it. So central part of life.
It's a great shout. Great shout. Okay. One dessert.
Again, that's easy. And if you ask any of my kids what desserts I would choose, they would all unanimously say a tiramisu. It's just the perfect dessert. It's actually a good one for sharing as well. I always feel slightly guilty for having a whole dessert. So why don't we just put a tiramisu in the middle and then we all devour it?
But you're probably slightly quicker.
Yeah, I've got years of training.
See, you say. You feel bad about sharing a dessert, right? When I started eating,
I just don't necessarily want to have a full meal, have a full dessert. But I said rather not have one, I'll share one.
Just eat less with the meal. So when I went high fat, zero carb, right? I've been doing it for about 4 months. It was going really, really well. Felt great. Christmas Day. This is when Fern and I were still together. Her dad came around. Her dad was a food technologist, right? He's one of those people, he's always experimenting with something in baking. He's always trying stuff out and figuring out how things work. And he's a really very talented cook. He brought round Christmas Day. I had just mentioned in passing a ginger cheesecake that somebody had made years before and that really stayed in my mind because it was just stunningly good. And he brought round a ginger cheesecake Christmas Day. And I didn't share it with anybody.
That's good.
It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And again, it helped make me the man I am today.
Yeah, but putting some... I'm not a big foodie. I'm lucky enough to eat very well, but I eat to live rather than live to eat. But for me, food is shared experience. Being in a lovely restaurant or on a beach or having a bottle of rosé and a fish in south of France or Italy or whatever. But tiramisu fits squarely into that sort of shared experience.
It's a good shout. Okay. You're down to your two pieces of advice now. This is where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
Any order, any time.
I found the question of younger advice, younger to older, really difficult because I don't fully understand how you can give your older self advice from a young person. I can understand it the other way around. And I think if anything, if I was trying to be young, trying to leave myself a note to read when I was much older, it would be just really the importance of family, because when you're little, your parents are your heroes.
Well, they're permanent as well, aren't they?
Absolutely, and you think they're there forever. And as you grow up, you sometimes you don't give them the credit that's due, and you treat them a bit unfairly. But they're still there for you. And as you get older, sometimes I find with my kids, I do love my kids. Sometimes they're a pain in the ass. I want a bit of me time. And I've got a child who is going, Dad, I need you. And just to drop everything, probably as my parents did for me, it's just so important. And just remembering just that importance of family the whole way through your life.
Yeah. Okay. I think the thing about the younger to older advice thing in this, what I was thinking about when I said that was about sometimes we forget as we get older. We forget all sorts of things. We forget to have fun. We forget to look around. We forget to just do some really basic shit that was really important to us when we were younger. That's sort of what I was thinking about. Anyway, sorry, carry on. What's next?
For me, that forgetting as well is actually remembering to call the kids And obviously you call them and you go into message or whatever, or they're too busy. But it's so easy just to send a text message and organize everything through messaging. And actually to carve out time for each other and talk is so important.
Yeah. What's your next bit of advice?
The other way is much easier, older to younger. When you're young and you hit problems, the first time you experience that problem, you don't know that there could be a solution to it. And it's just, it's probably back to find a way or make a way. There is a solution to everything. Just find a way, make a way, have confidence in yourself. You will get through. We've all been there. We've all done it. You will learn. But just find a way around problems.
Very fair. Excuse me. I was saying to my kids, I was talking to them in very general terms, but I was talking about, you know, my daughter was asking me about, she's like, is it all right to have a crush on your teacher? I'm like, there is a whole Simpsons episode about that. It's more than all right. Don't worry about it. And I was explaining to her, and we were all together, me and my kids. And I just said, the thing is, right, when you're young, these things can almost seem overwhelming because you've never experienced it before.
Yeah.
It's brand new. This is the first time your body and your brain are doing this. And it's like, I remember the intensity of my first love, Maz, when I was, we first met when I was 16. I think I was 17 when we got together. And, you know, I still dream about her now. But I know that when I'm dreaming about her, I'm actually dreaming about a time when life was really, really simple, rather than it specifically being about her. But the intensity of that and the certainty of that first love, it does come from the newness of it. You're just so damn sure this is it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is definitely going to last forever. Definitely.
I'm having conversations with my mother about love and her saying sort of, I said, well, how will I know when I found the right person? And she went, you'll know. And it's just that certainty of you find the person you think you're going to spend the rest of your life with. But then, I know what you mean about those first loves. They were glorious. The hormones were raging. And that when you hear a child screaming in pain or whatever, they're screaming partly because they don't know that the pain will go away, because it might be the first time they've had that experience, the other end of the spectrum on it. And it's just that advice to young people, there it will go away, and there is a solution.
Yeah, cool. Simon Thomas, Executive Chairman, Hippodrome Casino, London. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. And thank you for the tips about Max and Cat's Cradle and Tatty. Are we following them up?
We'll see.